This is Our American Stories, and we got a great crew here, and we try to feature their work as often as we can. And one of our favorite segments is Jesse's World, and it's that time.
In order to protect African cows from ravenous lions, Australian researchers have begun painting eyes on the rear end of cows. Lions are ambush predators, and they rely on stealth and the element of surprise in order to bring down their prey. As soon as they lose that element of surprise, as soon as the prey sees them, they abandon their hunt. That's why Dr. Neil Jordan and his fellow researchers are going to Botswana to paint eyes on cows' rumps. They hope it'll prove a low-cost way to protect livestock from lions and lions from being killed by farmers in retaliation. Dr. Jordan trialed his idea, which he calls iCow, last year with promising results. The researchers stamped painted eyes onto the butts of one-third of a herd of 62 cattle, making sure their eyes were large, easily visible, and potentially intimidating. While three unpainted cows were killed by lions, all the painted cows survived to graze another day. If successful, iCow would be an affordable tool for farmers. Losing one cow costs five times as much as painting a herd of 60 cattle. Livestock auctioneers, spit some dope rhymes in glorious rap mashups. Watch out, Jay-Z. These livestock auctioneers are coming for your hip-hop crown. Vine user Auctioneer Beats, also known as Graham Haven Rich from Chicago, has mashed up a bunch of the animal sellers' tight rhymes over some rap beats. The auctioneer's natural cadence and flow, which, according to Modern Farmer magazine, they pick up at a special training school, fuse perfectly with the music. If animals were meant to cover rock and roll hits, they probably would have been born with better singing voices. But thankfully for us, that doesn't stop Insane Cherry. The YouTube channel returns with another creature-dubbed masterpiece, Joan Osborne's One of Us. Splicing in barks, meows, hee-haws, and other beastly sounds from internet videos, Insane Cherry has also rendered Queen's We Will Rock You and Linkin Park's Numb. Watching the animals in Insane Cherry's latest ask, "What if God was one of us?" takes rock and roll theology to a whole new level. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Thank you for that, Jesse. And by the way, who gets the job of painting the cow butt? That's what I want to know. And do they kick cows like horses? I mean, because you're not supposed to get behind a horse.
I don't know.
I don't know either. Well, that brings us to another segment. And by the way, I love Joan Osborne. And now I can never think of her the same way again, Jesse. I can never think of that song. By the way, written by Eric Bazalian of the Hooters. That song. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, now I do.
Well, now you do. There you go. And now we want to talk about one of our favorite beats, because our friends over at NPR do some really decent and actually sometimes admirable storytelling, but they also do it in a way that you'll truly find, well, you'll find it only on NPR the way they do it, which we love to bring you in our regular series called Only on NPR. For today's report, our field correspondent Alex Cortez brings you their coverage on the topic of the minimum wage, which they dedicated a week of coverage to. Here's Alex.
Good day to you, and welcome to All Things Considered, a show where we talk very softly and right into the mic. Do you hear that? I'm whispering right in your ear. I'm right in your ear. Buzz, 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 buzz.
That was Family Guy's take on NPR. And here's the real deal, their host, Jeremy Hobson.
All this week, we're looking at the issue of the minimum wage and whether it should be raised from the current $7.25 an hour at the federal level.
But is NPR really posing a question as professional journalists? Or are they just pretending to and really giving us all answers as activists? Let's take a listen.
Each day this week, as part of our series, we're going to hear from a different worker making at or near minimum wage.
NPR started off by speaking with Bridget Hughes, who works at Wendy's. She began there at 16 years old, making $7.25 an hour, and now at 25, makes $8.75.
Is there any hope for you to get a raise just within the company without the government coming in and saying we're raising the minimum wage?
Bridget says there are promotion opportunities, but...
You know, for whatever reason, haven't gotten there yet.
She says for whatever reason, as if it's unknown. But in the same interview, she details the reasons.
I have been considered for promotions before, but have been told I was too emotional. I've been told that somebody was more qualified, you know, various reasons.
NPR failed to follow up on this inconsistency. And worse, they failed to celebrate the good news that Bridget herself recognizes. There is a path for her to greater opportunity and to higher pay.
I am working towards getting promoted within the company.
In all of NPR's storytelling during Minimum Wage Week, not once did they tell the story of someone who started at the minimum wage and climbed up that ladder of opportunity.
Not once.
They just couldn't bring themselves to do it. But here at Our American Stories, we don't have such bashfulness.
You're bashful.
Oh, gosh.
Here's one of our stories last year with an Indian immigrant named Daljeet Hundal, who at 19 years old started working at Carl's Jr.
I took that job. I worked part-time as a cook, making minimum wage at night just to pay my bills.
The minimum wage was around $2 an hour back then.
And as I was going through school, trying to work full-time and that, the opportunity came up with Carl's to get into their training program and become a manager eventually. So I did that. I was a shift manager, then an assistant manager, and then I became a general manager of a restaurant in 1978. And then about 2.5 years after that, I was a district manager. And a couple years after that, I was promoted to regional director of operations.
Daljeet now owns 16 Carl's Jr. franchises and 14 Jamba Juices, the same guy who started at $2 an hour.
And when we come back after these messages, more on our Only at NPR Minimum Wage series, The Story They Didn't Tell. This is Our American Stories, and we continue with our field correspondent Alex Cortez's experience spending some time, actually, with NPR and their minimum wage coverage. They spent a week on this, and let's pick up where we left off.
Daljeet now owns 16 Carl's Jr. franchises and 14 Jamba Juices, the same guy who started at $2 an hour. And this isn't some cherry-picked, isolated story. Here's yet another about a minimum wage worker that we told that NPR wouldn't.
You know, I came in this country in 1990 from Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a very poor country, and I came in this country, first of all, I was in culture shock. I had no clue what was going on here. And second of all, the problem was I didn't speak any English. So, you know, I started looking at a job. Nobody would hire me. You know, I was a very, very bad situation in my life. So, you know, all of a sudden I walked into a White Castle restaurant in Elmhurst, Queens, New York. And I had this conversation with this gentleman named Eugene Miller. And I sort of communicated my situation with him with broken language. One word here, one word there. And luckily my sister-in-law was here with me. And she was able to help me express myself, what my situation is. And Mr. Miller was very kind. He actually offered me a job on the spot. He said, hey, listen, you can come and join our team. You really don't need English to cook hamburgers. That's what my sister-in-law told me in my own language. You are more than welcome to join. And I was able to join that location. If White Castle was not there, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Like Daljeet Hundal, Jahangir Kabir worked his way up.
I had a desire to learn and learn English. So once I learned really English good, I was able to move up within the company. I became an instructor, I became a co-manager, I became a general manager. Right now, I'm a district manager running 8 locations in New York City.
Step by step, adding those qualifications that the Wendy's employee NPR interviewed said her bosses were looking for, but that NPR made sound like an impossible dream, like the government is her only savior. Next, NPR spoke with Jane McGinn, owner of Sweet Jane's Ice Cream Shop in Astoria, Queens, in New York City.
Sweet Jane.
And asked her this question.
And they're making what at this point? In terms of money, how much money do they make?
For NPR, it's all about the money they make. And not at all about the experience, the relationships, and the wisdom they get too. Which NPR didn't ask about a single time. And all of which can become more valuable than money itself, as you'll often hear about on the hit show Shark Tank.
You have the business experience and the knowledge that I lack.
Many entrepreneurs actually want the experience, the relationships, and the wisdom of the sharks more than they even want the money. But not NPR.
How much money do they make?
In truckloads! Cash.
Jane had constructed this beautiful ladder of opportunity that was available to all of her employees. And yet NPR failed to mention how a $15 minimum wage would deconstruct this very ladder. Suddenly, the higher qualified person who was making $13 an hour is making the same amount as the brand new hire who was making $9.50 an hour. How is that fair?
It's not fair! It's not fair!
And if we're all equal, why even work harder and take that next step on the ladder if there's no reward? The business owner might not be able to afford creating such a tiered ladder that's higher than $15 an hour. Or they may just not hire inexperienced workers at all and have to solely rely on the experienced workers whose productivity they know will guarantee a return on investment at $15 an hour.
Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Jane laments this prospect.
The kid who's having their first job has no idea what it's like to be an employee. They have to learn, and somebody has to take the time to teach them that. And that's one thing that I pride myself on is, you know, someone did that for me when I was a kid. Someone did that for my daughter when she was a kid. And I really want to be able to offer that value to the neighborhood, the community, and those kids that need to cut their teeth so that they're great employees when they go on and, you know, do their life's dream work.
Another question NPR failed to ask, why $15 an hour?
How much do you think you should be making for what you're doing?
15 minimum.
What's the magic in this number? Maybe there isn't any. One of their guests proposed even higher.
It's money, money, money by the money, money, money.
Well, what do you think you should be making for the work that you're doing?
Minimum wage should be somewhere around like $21.
$21 an hour.
Yeah.
But why stop at $21 an hour? Why not $25? Why not $100? Why not $1,000?
You're going to have to pay me $1,000,000.
Why are folks being so stingy proposing $15?
Sorry.
Heck, why are there any limits?
$100 billion.
Gentlemen, silence.
Businesses create a certain value for customers, a certain value that customers pay them for, and can only support a certain labor expense to stay in business at all.
I wouldn't mind paying more if people wouldn't mind paying more for a scoop of ice cream.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
In the world of our dreams, none of this would be an issue. The world wouldn't have limited resources. Its inhabitants would have unlimited resources at their disposal. Free ice cream, anywhere, one turned. Sounds like heaven, but back down here on Earth, in the world we live in, there's this little thing called reality. Which is still one heck of a reality, especially in this land we call the United States of America.
So I went across the street, and a big sign in this window said, "Help Wanted," and I walked in and met a guy by the name of Ed Brown. I said, "Mr. Brown, my name's Ed Renzi, and I need a job. And I got to make $85 an hour a week. Because that's my living expense." He said, "Well, that won't be any problem. We pay 85 cents an hour, and you could work 100 hours a week." I said, "Hell, I've done that all my life. That's not a problem."
Done
and
deal.
Literally, I went to work for McDonald's the first month I was there, February. I worked 100 hours a week. I didn't have a car. I walked home every day. Still managed that apartment building. I'll tell you, you talk about tired. Good news was I got a free lunch and a dinner, so the grocery bill was taken care of. Then they put a sign up, said managers wanted, and I signed up. I said, I'd like to be a manager. How much do they pay? And they said, they pay $95 a week. I said, I got a $10 raise coming. And I only have to work 70 hours. I signed up as a manager trainee. I started February the 2nd, 1966, and left there in 1999.
Ed Renzi left as the CEO of McDonald's, all the way from 85 cents an hour for 100 hours a week. Only in America.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
This has been the latest edition of our Only on NPR series. I'm Alex Cortez.
And great work on that, Alex. So nowhere in that NPR piece, not once did they talk about someone who rose up the ladder?
Not once.
I mean, our big, great research team here, just through our interviews, this is just people we've spoken to, because we ask a very important question, and we love the segment, and it's called First Jobs Fridays. And from that springs all kinds of remarkable things. And we also do an On Leadership segment. And in that, we ask, of course, what do we ask? What's your first job and how much did you get paid? Anything else there? I mean, did they talk about, you know, 15, 20, 25? Did they talk about increased price of goods? I mean, was there anything about the social cost, Alex, in the NPR series as it relates to minimum wage?
No, not at all. Yeah, just wait till you hear the next one, Lee, about whiteness.
That's our next one.
Yeah.
Whiteness. I'm Lebanese and I'm Italian, so I can't wait.
The privilege of whiteness.
The privilege of whiteness. We're looking forward to that. And thanks for that work, Alex, Greg, on the production, only on NPR. And this is Our American Stories, and we love bringing you the full stories. And Ed Renzi's, by the way, is a part of our On Leadership series. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Listen to that. Also, listen to Brad Anderson's story. He started at Best Buy, and as he called himself, he was a hippie who hated work. And he ended up becoming the CEO of Best Buy.
Not even any commission, or not any minimum wage. He was purely commissioned, and he didn't sell anything for months. He tried to quit, and they wouldn't let him.
They wouldn't let him quit. It's a great story. And by the way, there are people who have wage issues, and there are wage issues in this country, and it's worthy of discussion. But you got to bring both sides, and that's what we do here on Our American Stories, and always we do it through storytelling. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
If it hadn't been for love, never would have run through the blinding rain without $1 to my name. If it hadn't been for love.
And you're listening to Chris Stapleton, whom we love to feature, and his work on the Steel Drivers was amazing, and his solo work is even better. And pick up his records if he's coming through town. See him. He's actually opening for Guns N' Roses, of all bands. What a twofer you get. He's up in Nashville and a few other places. Chris Stapleton, as talented a singer as there is out there today. And we love music here on Our American Stories. And each week, we do a Marriage on the Mind segment. And periodically, we like to talk to people who are in broken marriages, people who've had divorce. We talk to people who've been married 60 years, young couples, and we love to talk to single people who, well, they never want to get married. My second oldest brother, Randy, has never wanted to get married. He made that clear. He's not married. He's in his mid-50s. It just wasn't for him. Wasn't his bag. My oldest brother, he got married. He got divorced. I'm in a marriage and I can't get divorced because my wife will kill me. And I don't believe in it anyway. So I'm hoping I won't. My parents didn't. And we love to talk about marriage because it's important and it's an important institution. And we like to, well, we don't want to blow it up and put it to bed. And I think a lot of people think it doesn't matter. And joining us always is Deb Wolniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And, well, this week we had to return to last week because we had had some audio and an interview with Deb and a young man named Brian. Not so young, actually, and we're going to dig into his life because I thought, my goodness, that was just so interesting. I wanted to talk to him first. Deb Wolniak is on the line. She's listening. But, Brian, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
And, Brian, tell me just a little bit. You know, we went to the interview, and Brian was just a sort of a confirmed bachelor who just didn't see the point in getting married. But before we dig into that, tell me a little bit about where you were born, Brian, a little bit about your life.
I was born out in rural Wisconsin, Oconomowoc, to be exact. So a little bit of a country boy. Grew up in suburbs, Brookfield. Had pretty much every opportunity in life afforded to me by two great parents who are still together. Went off to college and in Milwaukee and traveled the world from there. Never stayed in one place for too long.
Well, and you seem like you've got the world on a string. You're having a blast. You're trying all kinds of new things. And I caught from you that, you know, marriage was just, it's just not for you because it's going to pin you down and, well, it's not worth the risk. I want to play a clip. Want you to hear it. I want to ask you a question about it. It seemed to be a recurring theme, Brian. And let's take a listen.
Half my friends are either married. The other half are already divorced. I've got friends that are paying alimony. I've got, you know, for what? For why? Like, for able-bodied adults, alimony, for what? Like, this is what I'm looking at. The ones who are married don't seem particularly happy. They definitely don't seem like their former selves. And the ones who are divorced, they're like, I'm never going back to that again. And you got to ask yourself, a guy like me, not just my friends, but we're talking about everybody I look up to, the Kobes, the Arnolds. I mean, how many more great men who are smarter than me, men who are at the top of their craft, Tigers, how many more men like that do I have to watch get chopped in half in some family court before I go, you know, maybe this isn't the best route for me. I do a risk-benefit assessment and say, what am I getting in exchange for all this risk as a guy?
And so that I think that was the recurring theme for us listening, Brian. And by the way, when we were listening, half our crew was just drop-dead laughing and not laughing at you. It was just your bluntness was beautiful. You were telling it is. Talk to us about that risk, Brian. What is the risk to you about all this?
The risk is just egregious. Guys are getting bent over. Now, I noticed I named a couple of guys. I said Kobe. I said Arnold. Those are all cheaters, by the way, but Johnny Depp isn't. Mel Gibson isn't when he was on his answer machine, leaked messages, screaming about his Laker tickets. The risk is egregious. You're talking about paying for you got a situation where two people are together. The people break up, and one person gets to continue living as if they never broke up, and the other person has to pay for it. Somebody explain these ridiculous laws. Don't tell me the law. I want somebody to explain the law. If I asked you about murder, you would be like, well, that's what the law says. And all the girls, you know, everybody in my audience is like, yeah, that's what the law says. It's like, you would be like, life is the most precious thing, can't be taken away lives. You would go into an elaborate explanation like to a child. I'm asking for somebody to do that to me. Break it down for me why these laws exist today. And they're ridiculous. Can guy after guy after guy, you got 40 years old, sleeping on futons, eating ramen, making six figures. It's ridiculous. It boggles my mind. I can't understand why any guy would sign up for such an institution.
Well, let's play one more clip because I want to dig into the generational nature of this as well. Because now we have so many kids who are the products of divorce running around this country and have seen and witnessed this. And legitimately, Brian, it is carnage. I mean, I know a lot of kids who are families of divorce. I know good men and women who are the products of divorce and what's happened to them because of it. And it creates real damage. Let's listen to a little bit more of Brian talking to Brian and Lee.
Social media has gassed them up. That's what we say in the black community. We call it getting gassed up. It's when your ego is like, when you're a barista and you're getting the attention that you couldn't get a couple, like 50 years ago, you couldn't get that kind of attention in 10 lifetimes. And now they're getting it on the weekend. So a guy like me who sounds good on paper, hi, former model, you know, makes about 70 grand a year, world travel, multilingual, that's nice, but you're not 6'3". Exactly.
But you're not 6'3". So there's something about the current culture that you also think makes life even more risky.
Yeah, you know, these, I don't know if you've been out there. I mean, I have been in long-term relationships, 6 years with my longest, but I've been on hundreds of dates ever since then, and I'm telling you, these aren't the mother of your kids. You can't bring these girls home to mom. They're covered in tattoos. They're speaking in gangsterisms like bust a cap, and this party is lit, fam. She says like every third word. These aren't the mother of my kids. I mean, and these are the girls that are holding out. It's like, who's kidding who here? It's like, you know, I come from a family, we don't settle. If you don't find something that's good enough, this, you just say, this won't do, and you stand back. And it, I know you come from a debating background, Lee, so I can put it in philosophical terms where I don't have the burden of proof. I'm not sufficiently convinced at this time that marriage is in my best interest. Now, anybody who's asserting that it is making a positive assertion, and I welcome them to show me the evidence for it. But right now, I just haven't heard enough good reasons.
Now, I don't think there's ever a reason to debate somebody into marriage, Bryant. I mean, debates for fun, sure, between guys and gals to test their wits. I can tell you, as a guy who was single and was single, and very much like you, I thought, what's the upside for me? But I didn't have a bias towards marriage. Either way, I thought, well, it clearly benefits a whole bunch of people. I mean, my own mom and dad. I watched the institution of marriage when my parents' marriage ran up against the rocks just a couple of times, luckily because there was a church nearby and there were some good friends. I watched my parents get on the other side of the marriage, and I watched their relationship deepen, and I watched their friendships and the family deepen. And then I always projected, because my dad would, he never sold us marriage, but he'd always say, you know, son, it's interesting to live your life backwards. And when you're 70, your proudest achievements, I promise you, will not be your work. They'll be your family. Because those relationships you have in your 20s and 30s, when the time you hit your 40s, no disrespect, son, it's going to look a little silly and shallow. And by the time you're in your 50s, you're going to be sitting around going, what am I doing with my life? This is what did it for my dad. And he never made me get married. I didn't get married, Bryant, so this hopefully can inspire you, until I found the right lady at the age of 43.
Fair enough, and that's a beautiful thing. I got a similar speech from my dad, who said the same thing, and I don't disagree with it. I don't disagree with it. If you can find something out there, that is beautiful, that to leave that kind of legacy. But we're talking about exclusive benefits here. We're talking about marriage, the legal contract. You're joining your assets. This is a legally binding. I mean, people talk, you dress it up with the pomp and circumstance. You make this proud proclamation to the top of the building. You invite all your friends and family. Now, I don't know if you know, but on the weekends, I'm a wedding DJ, and I'm also a club DJ, so I see both sides. I see the people on the
club.
Yeah, and then I see the girls at the divorce party. Oh, the single ladies. Oh, the single ladies. So I see both sides. And you got to tell the kids both stories. And you're right. At the end of the day, I did that through my 20s. That's not what I want to do. I'm not chasing girls anymore. I'm working on my business. That's the kind of legacy I'm going to leave. And if I want to adopt or get a surrogate, that's fine. I don't see any evidence that shows that a guy, a single father, is exposing their kids to all sorts of risks. Now, there is some risks associated with single motherhood, and I don't know why that is, but I haven't seen any of that information.
Well, Brian, hold that thought. When we come back on the other side, I'll have a few more questions. Deb Wolniak is going to join us. And this is Our American Stories. This is our Marriage on the Mind segment. And my goodness, we love Bryant. We think he should just maybe be a regular. The single guy beat. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we're continuing with Bryant, and we're joined, as always, by Deb Wolniak, who brought us Bryant last week and joins us on the air. Deb, thanks for joining us, and Brian, thanks for being back with us.
As always.
You're welcome.
You bet. Brian, I wanted to take one more line of approach with you, and then we'll open it up with Deb as well. But one of the things that I think is just the statistics. You were talking about using reason. If we were to look at the data of who's happier and wealthier in this country, married people lead the pack.
The ones who stay married, yeah.
Well, of course.
You know which one.
Of course,
yeah,
no question.
Know,
but let's put it this way.
Nobody walked down the aisle expecting to get divorced. I've been at a ton of weddings, and everybody's up there crying and telling their great stories about how they met and how they knew they were the one. Yeah. Only 2 years later, they're apart. It's like, how do you know?
You don't know somebody until you know somebody. This is true, and I would say the same for starting a business. How do you know? But you start one.
Exactly.
And you say the same thing about half the people I know who are lawyers don't like it, half love it. But if you don't go out there and practice law, how do you really know? But I will ask you one last question, then we're going to move on. In the end, I guess this question I ask a lot of single people. I was sitting next in an airplane next to a very attractive, very nice single woman who, as we started to talk, she said, I don't, she was saying what you were saying. I want love. I mean, the kind of love my parents have. And I want to have kids and I want to have it in a family. I don't want to just get a kid. And I'm afraid that I'm not going to find that love, but I'm afraid to give that love. And it's sort of a devil's, it's sort of a devil's paradox, a devil's choice. You're almost creating your own, your own devil's paradox here. I mean, sooner or later, if you don't take that leap of faith, Brian, you may not know what you never knew.
Exactly. It's kind of like the lottery. You can't win if you don't play, they say.
Yeah, you can't. And you're an entrepreneur. So you are a real risk taker with your money. You're a real risk taker with your capital, with your life, with your time in every other endeavor. By the way, you want to talk about dangerous, Brian. 9 out of 10 businesses fail.
That's true, but I take educated risks. I do my diligence, and they always pay off. And if anybody knows me as a businessman, I've done quite well for myself because I do my homework first. And that's the kind of stuff that courtship is supposed to offer me, is an insight into the individual and whether or not we're compatible. And quite frankly, I just haven't met one that is. Now, I know in the last one you said there's nothing you can do to convince Brian. That's not true. If somebody comes along, they're more than welcome to be a part of my life. I'm not closing the door here. I'm just saying that marriage as an institution is ruled out. We can be partners, but there's no need to add that extra. See, that's how a lot of guys get caught. I've seen these guys, this 1,000-yard PTSD war veteran stare in some family court. Like, what happened? Because they got cut. They got the old right there Fred. They were swinging for the fences on that extra stuff. It's like, that's how guys get caught. If I got a nice lady, we're going to settle down. We can do that. But we could even have a sham wedding. Nobody has to know we didn't go down to the courthouse. I'm just saying.
You want none of the legal entanglements, which brings me in with Deb here. And Deb, you know, you're hearing this. You know, this is what you do for a living, and you're not just hearing this from Brian. I mean, I would assume that this is a millennial cry for a whole bunch of reasons. And part of the reason just might be, A, they've seen a lot of divorce, and B, life's so uncertain for these millennials. I don't think they're ever going to see Social Security. I think the economy's not looking good. I don't think they see the future the way generations, you know, 30, 40, and 50 years ago did. And that's our fault. I mean, that's on the adults, frankly, for having the levels of divorce we have and for doing what we've done to the generation. But talk about this, Deb. You see it a lot.
I have to, first of all, give Bryant kudos because not only he is very well spoken on the matter, but the one thing that we didn't say last week that I want to say this week, he respects the institution of marriage very clearly. He does because he knows it's very important as far as your commitment is concerned. Once you make that commitment, you're committed. He understands that level because he's done that in the business world. He also knows that choosing the right spouse when you do that or if you do that is critically important to the success of the marriage. And he actually gave me a business idea right when he was talking. He probably didn't even realize it, but I'm going to throw this out. If you guys want to collaborate offline, I'm totally fine with that. I think one of the things that we need to do in this country is create an educated way that we can work with millennials to teach them what is being single well look like, what is being married well look like, and walk them through those steps. It may look like old school to a lot of people, but that's what I keep hearing from millennials. I want the marriage that my grandparents had. Maybe not that my parents had, because maybe they got divorced or whatever. It depends on the person. But the reality is they've seen couples somewhere. If it's not in their family line, they've seen them somewhere where they look at them and they see them holding hands at McDonald's and they're still talking in their 70s. And you're like, see, that's exactly what I want. I mean, they're just getting a burger and they're happy and they're talking. Why can't I get that? I think the desire is there for millennials. The question is, how do I connect the dots and how do I protect myself? So I'm going to throw this back real quick because I don't know if we asked this last week to Brian. But Brian, do you believe in prenups?
I know that they are not as efficacious as people think that they are. And that would be one of the things that on the single side, I would be educating young men about that. These things get tossed out. For example, if a young man gets his soon-to-be bride to sign a prenup without the presence of her lawyer, it can be tossed out. If he tries to include anything in there about no child support payments, it will be tossed out. On and on, mm-hmm. on and on down the list.
Okay. So there are legal things, and especially in this day and age, that move very quickly, that this is why there are legal people in place. If you are going to put together a quote-unquote business contract, because let's face it, this is a business decision. If you want to take the love piece out of it, it is. It's usually ironclad, and the amount of work that needs to be done to separate those two partners is insanely expensive and completely emotionally draining. It's unbelievable. So I totally get the concern, as you're saying, should I be taking that jump or not? But if I do believe, and Bryant, you can throw out your thoughts, if we learn how to be single well, we know ourselves well, and then we also can go through a process of learning and understanding other people well and knowing that we're reducing that risk level, that you can make that educated decision, that potentially then we're starting to talk the same language and preparing in such a way. Do you agree?
The problem with people is that they are opportunistic, and in my experience, they can change. When I think is a valid verbal or even written contract that we've executed might be subject to change. She might have kids and decide to no longer go back into the workforce. Like we agreed to be spending equal. And that happens. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of guys in that. We call those cheaper to keeper marriages. I got three buddies right now that wouldn't be mad if they got divorced, in their own words, because they're in these cheaper to keeper marriages where I'm not terribly happy, but, you know, it's going to cost me an arm and a leg, and I'm going to get some financial amputation if I end up getting divorced. But they're like, you know, even that sounds preferable than what I'm living right now. I got guys that are making six figures living paycheck to paycheck because, you know, their partner's ratcheting up the spending. He's standing in the bay window there looking at another Amazon truck pulling up saying, what did she order this time? It's like, come on. I mean, I got guys that are like that. I'm telling you.
Right, right. So I'm going to throw this out for people who are listening and they're resonating maybe with both sides of this equation. Number one, if you're married and you're not married well, you need to get educated to be married well. That's why great marriages and organizations like ours around the country exist, to help you be better and stronger. If you have made that commitment, it's clear that if you try to change that, it is going to be devastating financially and emotionally. I can tell you, I've seen enough people go through our program here at Great Marriages that they are happier after 6 weeks through our mentoring program with Prepare and Enrich than they are if they never went through it at all and just sustained that status quo. And so, yes, there is a possibility to get better. Both have to want to do that, and that's important. And then on the other side, when you look at your life as a single, I think knowing who you are and knowing what you want and respecting that space and making those educated decisions are very, very important in knowing what your risk tolerance is and trying to make those best decisions. But I will tell you this, Bryant, you will never have the full crystal ball. And yes, that is a leap of faith. And yes, it is a commitment. But I love the fact that you know the deepness of that commitment. I think you're farther along than a lot of people that maybe you're just walking down the aisle next week.
And as you said, I definitely value the institution. I mean, it's given me a great life. I'm a product of one, and I don't discount that. I'm obviously joking a lot. I joke a lot. I try to get a couple laughs out of it. But I think you guys are doing great work at marriages. And I don't want to paint them the grass is greener. Sometimes these girls or guys that want to get a divorce think, well, maybe I want to be single, living like me. But it's not for them. It's not for everybody. So I don't want people to get the wrong idea. But if you know what you want, I'm not opposed to going after it.
Well, Bryant, you stay in touch with us. We really do want to hear maybe a memoir or notes every month or so from a single guy. And
for sure.
It's important. And, you know, so many Americans are single. And so many Americans think and feel exactly like you. And again, it's we adults who screwed it up. I mean, and I can tell you as a Christian, it's a particularly infuriating that the divorce rate in Christian households is so darn high. It's disgraceful. Yep. And Deb Wolniak, as always, thanks for bringing Bryant to us. And thanks for all the great work you do at Great Marriages for Sheboygan County. This is Lee Habib, Marriage on the Mind, Bryant and Deb. Maybe we'll do it again soon, you two. More after this. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell every kind of story. Good ones, bad ones, sad ones, happy ones, stories about people, stories about towns. We did a story on the city of Denver and how it came to be, the great train robbery, an event. And sometimes an ad tells a story. And some guy was trying to sell his Dodge Viper on Craigslist and posted a hilarious sales pitch that warns the reader of an impending doom should they choose to purchase said Viper. Here's that ad read by our in-house talking computer, Ed.
Okay. Full disclosure. I almost killed myself in it. It is very powerful. Extremely, extremely fast. I've driven Ferraris that don't feel as crazy as this thing. I am frankly afraid of it now. That's right. It's in my garage and I'm afraid to drive it because it's like a crazy steroid bull that wants to kill me. I've done 130 miles per hour on a Ducati while laughing into the face of death. The Viper is a completely different bowl of crack. The engine sounds like 40 pit bulls eating kittens while lifting weights. I cannot truly explain its power. It has whiplash acceleration in third gear at 50 miles per hour. That sentence doesn't even make sense. But it's true. That's why I'm telling you. I will not have your soul on my conscience. You need to know what you are getting into. What insane level of crazy you are buying. Can you resist the urge to mash down the accelerator? Can you? Because it's like owning your own demon. A demon that wants to kill you. We all know one person that for the right amount of money would kill you. But since no one is paying, they smile in your face and go about their day. It's like that, except the Viper doesn't bother to ever pretend it doesn't want to kill you. And it will do it for free. Some brilliant engineer designed a beautiful, sexy, bulging body, fantastic suspension, great handling, aerodynamics, and all-American style. While he was out on his lunch break, some demented maniac dropped 100 times more engine power than necessary into it and sent it out the door. It's mentally unbalanced. Look. If you are the type of person that can be talked into having one more drink at midnight when you have a very important presentation or interview early the next morning, then the Viper is not for you. The whole car is constantly whispering sweet lies to you. You got this. Open me up and ride free. You got this. Are you a wussy? Just do it. Do it. You got this. Do not do it. You don't got it. You are a wussy. You will sit on the curb and settle your heart after it tries to kill you the first time. You will get back inside and it will immediately get back to the business of trying to get you to let it murder you. You got this. This time you know. That last time was just a fluke. You ain't no wussy, repeat after me. You don't got this. But for $30,000 you can look the devil in the eye and take this ride. You were warned.
Well, thank you, Jesse, and thank you, Ed. And by the way, I love that computer read, Jesse. Saves us. We're going to automation here. Absolutely. At Our American Stories. And from the sublime to the serious, our field correspondent, John Woods, serves in the Army National Guard. and he bumped across a troubling story from Major Paul Stubbs that was in the Marine Corps Times. And that's what we go from, Craigslist to the Marine Corps Times. And it was titled, quote, "Blowing off orders has become a troubling norm." And Major Stubbs graciously recorded it for us. And you're about to hear just how troubled he feels about it. You can actually hear the despondency in his voice. Here he is.
I think I'll grow a beard. It is increasingly apparent that more and more Marine Corps orders are just set aside because we're so busy answering higher-ups' mail and adding new requirements and systems to track and manage training and equipment. Not out of belligerence, just as a matter of course. It's non-malicious selective disobedience. Don't believe me? Then why do we take weeks or months preparing for readiness inspections? If we'd been executing the orders, we would all just be in compliance with standards as a matter of course. Any day of the week would be a good day for an inspection. But we don't comply until it becomes an absolute necessity. Operations shut down and Marines are pulled to help the sections get back in compliance, like Badlands corporals who live like pigs until Thursday afternoon inspections. Is that the new standard? As Marines, we keep our eye on the ball, hires intent. We get the items briefed at the commanding officer's weekly meeting done first. Units are 100% sexual assault prevention and readiness trained, but our vehicle record jackets haven't been updated in months and our weapons are dirty. But no one's asking about the vehicles or the weapons just now. And if our unit numbers are in red and the other units are in green, we look bad in front of the boss. The direction we're heading leaves us continually playing catch-up and clean-up as the requirements that actually get noticed change. This engenders a weapons turn-in mentality. We're busy, so only clean where they will look. The rest can rust. We have other things to do. I've had senior officers brush aside requirements because the unit was too busy. When they're confronted with the actual order to which that requirement pertained, they responded, "But there's no demand signal to spend time on this." "Really?" As if a compressed schedule translated into automatic exception. But commanders set priorities, and if they add rocks to a pack and never take any out, well-meaning career professionals have to decide for them which orders they will ignore. The answer is the ones that aren't enforced. Why is there never a discussion about getting rid of requirements, just adding new ones? For example, why does a lieutenant colonel who has never used tobacco have to take the online tobacco cessation class every year? Is that something that could perhaps be only required for tobacco users? Does a Marine married for 20 years with a crop of kids really need the class on preventing sexually transmitted diseases? Is he or she the target audience for this information? We preach top-down planning and bottom-up refinement, but we seem to skip that second part. We've chosen to stay on top of the things our higher commands put on their radar. The rest is set aside as something we pay attention to once every couple of years, when it again becomes important to leadership, command inspection scorecards. So, I think I'll grow a beard and see how long it takes someone to tell me I'm out of regulation. Then, if they're not of higher rank than me or able to reach into my chain of command, I will apply what seems to be our paradigm of ignoring it until there are actual consequences. Or maybe I should just keep shaving every day, and we should do a sanity check on the cost and hours of compliance and match that up against what we want the unit to do for the actual primary mission. But we can't do both, and we aren't.
And that's again from John Woods. And again, we love bringing you every kind of story, and we want to hear the real voices of the men and women who serve this country and the bureaucratic rules and norms they have to deal with and the political ramifications of some of this stuff that gets thrown at them. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our weekly series, Random Acts of Kindness. And if you have a great story of someone doing a random act of kindness for you, visit randomactsofkindness.org and post it there. And make sure to check out some of the terrific stories there. You'll be inspired. And it's a great character-building resource for families. And this week we bring you a story of a 7-year-old in Toledo, Ohio, named Audriana Reynolds, that we read about at lifeset.com. Audriana was bullied at school for being somewhat of a tomboy, which is just like my little girl, Reagan, 11 years old, and the things she loves to do are what only boys are supposed to love to do. And I love this country now because girls do whatever they want, and that's that, and they're going to have their way. Well, you won't believe this story, and we're lucky to have Audriana and her mother, Alexandria, on with us now. Audriana, before we start and before we tell your story, you're 7 years old. What's your idea of fun? You have a day off. It's the summer. How do you kill some time? Talk to us about what's fun in your life.
Riding my dirt bike and holding my turtle.
That sounds like a day. My little girl loves riding her ATV and catching frogs. So you two have a lot in common. Tell us, Audriana, what was going on at school? Tell us what was happening at school to you with the bullying.
They were touching me, hitting me, and calling names.
And what were they calling you names about, Audriana? What kind of names were they calling you, and why do you think they were doing that?
They were saying that I was a boy and ugly.
And was this mostly boys? Was this mostly boys, Audriana? Was this girls? Or was this just everybody?
Girls.
Really? Really? And, you know, just so the audience knows, Audriana's hair is short because in April she had donated the bulk of it to Wigs for Kids, an organization that provides wigs for children who need them. And most ordinarily, that's for young kids who've suffered from cancer and have lost their hair. It's a beautiful thing to do and a courageous thing to do. Alexandria, how did this affect your daughter and you too? And talk about what happened next.
Well, she would come home from school crying and just very upset. And, you know, she didn't really understand why kids were doing what they were doing and saying what they were saying about her. And it was just really hard to watch your child be, you know, so upset over just mean stuff that kids say and putting their hands on her and stuff to that effect. It all originally started as I was trying to get people to send Audriana birthday cards in the mail for her birthday to show her that there was plenty of nice people in the world and not everybody was mean. And one of the ladies in one of my coloring groups online, she actually knows the Punishers Motorcycle Club, and she actually hooked us up with Bush, and a pretty cool relationship just kind of started from there. They made her a vest and accepted her in as part of the club. And they took her for a ride on the back of the motorcycle to school and all kinds of cool stuff.
And the Punishers, it's sort of like a law enforcement motorcycle club in Toledo? That's what I thought. And we have Daniel on with us too, Daniel Bushy. And we're fortunate, Daniel, to have you here too. Tell us about that motorcycle club of yours and what you did for this family and this young lady. And I'm going to call her a young lady because that's what she is. And why you did it?
We help anybody we can, anytime our resources allow. We're very family oriented. We do special events. We just got done with a cancer run where we raise money for the Nightingale Harvest Ministries. So stuff like that, and all of our chapters do that. You know, we focus on our communities the best we can. And, you know, there's always people that need help. You know, it's just, you know, getting to the ones we can.
And so,
focused on friendship and family.
That's great. And this is what are the age groups of the folks in this motorcycle club, and what walks of life do they come from, Daniel?
Every walk. My charter has active police, active and retired military. I've got EMTs, firefighters, just anything you can think of. You know, we bring people in and they have to hang out with us for a while, you know, to make sure they're going to be a good fit and make sure we're all on the same page.
That's great. That's great. And so what did you do for this young lady in particular? What did you do for Audriana to help her with this bullying, help her with her self-esteem, her confidence, all of it?
When, just like she said, Angie reached out to us and said, I know somebody in my coloring group that her daughter's being picked on, and they wanted to know if you guys would send her a birthday card. And I got a hold of her mom, and I said, you know, what's going on? And she told us, she said, if you guys send a birthday card, it'd be great. I just wanted to know there's still nice people out there. And I said, we can do better than a birthday card. So about 8 or 10 of us got together, rode out to Peanut's grandma's house, and we hung out with her for about 45 minutes or an hour. And, you know, I talked to her. I had been bullied when I was younger. I used to be really small. And, you know, I got bullied a lot when I was a kid, too. Somebody set my hair on fire. I had a blade pulled on me, put to my neck. You know, just off the top of my head. So I understood, and I understand what she was going through at the time. And I told her, you know, it's not her fault. It's, you know, when people do that, it's usually because they have self-esteem issues. They feel bad about themselves, or they're having an issue at home. And it's not to be mean against anybody. It's just the way it is. You know, and I told her this, them picking on her has nothing to do with her, that she's a good person.
And that's beautiful. And so you took her on a ride to school is what you did.
Yeah, we came out to her house, picked her up. Me and my VP blocked some traffic on the way over to make sure we could get there in one piece, and brought her out to the school. She'd seen the kids as they were showing up to school. They're all wide-eyed and looking over at us, and there's like 8 bikers standing outside of the school. It was fun, though. She had a blast.
Well, and you were helping out a young lady with a common love for bikes. Adriana, can you tell us about your first real ride on a real motorcycle and what it meant to you?
It was fun, and I really liked it.
Well, hopefully
and
you'll...
It meant really a lot.
That's great, and hopefully you have a lot more. It sounds like you have some new friends, Alexandria. After you guys have expanded your family to include the Punishers, have you noticed any changes in your little girl?
Oh, definitely. She has a smile on her face all the time. Whenever she talks about them, she just lights up, and she loves telling everybody that she's part of the Punishers Motorcycle Club, and that she has a whole new family of uncles, and it just brought her a lot more confidence and happiness back into her, and it's so wonderful to see.
Well, that's beautiful. And Daniel, you got about 30 seconds. A final thought from you before we close.
Just anybody that's listening, you know, bullying is not okay. It affects kids badly. You know, it brings them down inside, and it's a lifetime effect. There's no reason for it. You know, just accept each other how you are. You know, everybody's different. That's what makes the world great.
Well, Daniel, Adriana, Alexandria, thank you, all three of you, but particularly you, Daniel. Thank you for reaching out. These random acts of kindness, these things we do for one another, and I call them little acts of love because that's what they are, and we all need them. And just thanks for what you did. And Adriana, you keep riding, okay, sweetheart? You keep riding. This is Lee Habib. Thank you all for joining us. And this is Our American Stories, our random acts of kindness. What a great story. What a great country. And it's so true. Bullying, it's a part of life, but it can be fought back. And this is the best way to fight back, with really, really random and radical acts of kindness. More after these messages with Our American Stories. We'll be right back. This is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. You're about to hear the story of an American who is considered to be the greatest athlete to have ever lived.
In 1951, radio broadcaster Bill Stern reported the greatest athlete of the first half of the century was sick and penniless. Stern told his listeners, if you don't have any money, send him a card and let him know you still think about him. The two-time Olympic gold medalist is considered by many to be the world's greatest athlete ever to live.
Whatever sport you happen to care about in America in 1912, Jim Thorpe did it better than anybody. I mean, if you were a track and field fan, he was the greatest runner in the world. If you were a baseball fan, he was one of the greatest baseball players in the world. If you were a football fan, he was the greatest football player in the world. He happened to be one of the great billiards players of all time, although people don't really know that about him.
After five decades, Jim Thorpe's life still plays like frontier fiction. He was born in a one-room cabin in Oklahoma Indian Territory, just 12 years after the Battle of Little Bighorn.
He has a kind of mythic quality. His life story was very dramatic. He kind of touches on all of the American themes about the frontier. He's kind of a half a modern sports figure and half a kind of Paul Bunyan American mythic figure.
There must be something in the Thorpe legend for people to still be talking about him 50 years after he's dead.
The way he played the game so embodied the warrior spirit that Americans cherish in their athletes that it has carried Thorpe all these years and makes him in many people's minds as alive and vivid as he was back then.
The specific source of Thorpe's warrior spirit was his Sac and Fox Indian tribe. On May 28, 1888, Jim and his twin brother Charlie were the progeny of Hiram and Charlotte Thorpe. Their father was half Irish and their mother one quarter French, but it was her Indian blood with which she identified. Thorpe lost his brother Charlie from pneumonia at age 8, and both his parents died when he was a teenager. As a child, the rambunctious Thorpe became his athletic father's protege, at times running 15 miles home from school.
Jim, how'd you get here?
He ran.
You ran 15 miles?
Only 12, Pa. I came through the hills.
I never was content, he said, unless I was trying my skill in some game against my fellow playmates or testing my endurance and wits against some member of the animal kingdom. Although he showed immediate promise, Thorpe was only a star in his schoolyards. That changed in the spring of 1907.
Who is that?
Attending Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, Thorpe decided to jump in with the runners during track practice one day.
Either I need a new watch, or we've got a new runner.
Carlisle's football and track and field coach, the legendary Pop Warner, immediately met with Thorpe.
You're Jim Thorpe.
That's right.
Glad to meet you, Jim. I'm Pop Warner. It's quite an exhibition you put on this morning.
Exhibition?
But you know what you did? You ran the 2:20 and 23 seconds flat with your clothes on. Why haven't you come out for the team?
Well, I hadn't figured on coming out for the team.
You just run for exercise, is that it?
I don't rightly know why I run.
Then Thorpe saw the high jumpers practicing.
Hello, Jim. Like to take a whack at it? Go ahead, it won't bite you.
He was walking with a couple of friends from the school over, and there were a couple of guys struggling in the high jump.
Yeah, get some lift into it.
And he watched it, and Thorpe handed a couple of books to his friend and went over and jumped over 5 feet, 8 inches in the high jump, the same height these guys had been struggling at. He had never high jumped before, and he was in street clothes.
2 years later, The 5 foot, 9.5 inch, 144-pound Thorpe added the first layer in what would become a national mythology when he almost single-handedly beat the opposing track and field team.
Pop, it's 2:30. The meet's supposed to start.
Well, let's get started.
Well, where's your team?
Right here.
Now, wait a minute. You're joking, aren't you?
This is Louis Tawanima. He runs the mile, 2 miles, 3 miles and up. And this is Jim Thorpe.
And what does he do?
Everything else.
Get on your mark.
Frequently, during these track meets, Jim would compete in 8 of the events. At the conclusion of these events, on the average, he would have garnered 6 gold medals.
After it was all over, Thorpe couldn't tell you how he did it, said Coach Warner. Everything came natural.
If he wanted to do something athletically, he didn't need coaching. He needed just to kind of observe it. He would watch and he would stare and he would see how things happen, and then he could go out and do it himself.
Then Thorpe saw the game of football.
He wanted to play football, but Pop Warner didn't want him to play because he didn't want his star track man to get hurt. Finally, Pop just said, well, okay, we'll give you a tryout. Threw the ball at him and says, okay, you're going to go through tackling practice, and this is the first team, and go. And he ran through the whole team. Pop got all over his team members and saying, I want you to hit him and put him down and make him stay down. And they gave him the ball again, and he ran through the team again. So Pop Warner made him a team member after that.
Thorpe was named All-American as a halfback, defender, punter, and place kicker.
He was so elusive as a runner. The men who played against him remembered how he would give you a hip and then take it away. He'd let you think you could tackle him, and then all of a sudden he'd be gone. The hip would disappear, and you'd see his heels.
Thorpe could also run through would-be tacklers. Future Notre Dame head coach Newt Rockne learned that the hard way.
He was playing left end for the Massillon Tigers, and I was playing left halfback. He slipped through and tackled me for a couple of yard losses, and I patted him on the shoulder. I says, young fella, you're doing wonderful. But look at all the people up here in the stand that come to see old Jim run. How about letting old Jim run? So the next time I carried the ball around, I hit him in the head with my knee and hip and bowled him over and went on down for a 60-yard touchdown. So after the point, after touchdown, here come poor old Rock with a player under each arm and all wetted down with a sponge, and I walked him and patted him on the shoulder. I said, that a boy, Rock, you let old Jim run, didn't you?
By 1911, Thorpe raised Carlisle to the top echelon of collegiate football.
48, 26, 32, 97, 41.
Harvard laid claim to the national championship, but before they could do that, they had to play Carlisle, and the Carlisle Indians beat them. Jim, with a badly swollen ankle, ran for 173 yards and kicked 4 field goals, the last being 48 yards to win the game 18-15.
Then came that grand summer of 1912. Thorpe shared his plan with Coach Warner.
What's on your mind?
I want to go over there, to the Olympics. I want to make a record they won't be able to ignore.
Good boy. That's the spirit. Which event would you like to compete in?
What events are there?
It's the 100 meter, 200 meter, the hurdles, the pentathlon.
Pentathlon. That's 5 events, isn't
it? That's right.
And this, the decathlon. That's 10 events.
Yes.
Enter me into both of them.
Jimmy, you're crazy.
Am I?
That's 15 events. You'd be competing against the greatest athletes in the world.
Pop, I've worked hard. Will you help me? Will you?
You know I will.
Here's sports historian Bert Sugar and gold medalist Billy Mills.
On the boat going over to the 1912 Olympics, Mike Murphy, one of the coaches, finds Thorpe in a hammock and says, Jim, aren't you going to practice? And Jim, with his eyes closed, goes, I'm just picturing how far I'm going to jump.
Jim Thorpe not only trained physically on that ship, but I think he was one of the few athletes training mentally. Today, visualization, imagery.
And when we come back on this day in history, more on the life story of Jim Thorpe. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and it's time for more of our story and our This Day in History, and it's Jim Thorpe's story. It's a story everyone should know, and if you ever get a chance to see the movie, Burt Lancaster does an amazing job in his life story. And as always, this is brought to us by Hillsdale College. Let's go to the next part of this story.
When Thorpe stepped off the boat in Stockholm, his exotic appearance and long, shambling strides intrigued the Swedes.
The Swedish fans began to call him a horse because he had kind of like a gait of a horse. And they would go every day to the stadium to see the horse. And damn if the horse didn't win every day.
Jim Thorpe, who had never competed in a decathlon in his life, starts off with a pentathlon and in one day wins.
He dominated the first event in the decathlon, which was the 100 meters. His shot put was better than anybody else's in the field. So by the time you get to the fourth event, it's pretty much over. He won by 700 points, and that's kind of like winning 15-0 in a baseball game or 45-0 in a football game.
To give you an idea how good he was in the decathlon, his total points were being achieved in 1924, 28, and 32. As many as 20 years later, they were only doing what Thorpe did.
His performance in Stockholm was one of the highlights of Olympic history. Afterwards, King Gustav said to him, "Sir, you are the greatest athlete in the world." To which he replied, "Thanks, King."
Well, being crowned the greatest athlete of the world by the King of Sweden, I think, is one of my great moments in my life.
Here's gold medal decathlete Bruce Jenner.
The title World's Greatest Athlete goes along with the Olympic champion in the decathlon. And it is a legitimate, standardized test of a person's athletic ability throughout history. He was world class in probably five or six events. Barring none, the greatest decathlete to ever live.
2 days after the track portion ended, he actually played an Olympic baseball game. Baseball was kind of an exhibition event in 1912, and the Americans got their best athletes, and they put Jim Thorpe out there in right field.
Thorpe returned home a star.
When the boat docked in New York, they were given a ticker tape parade. And Thorpe was put in the back of an open automobile and driven down Broadway, and people simply called his name and shouted his name. Thorpe is purported to have said, "Geez, I never knew a guy could have so many friends."
Thorpe picked up where he left off for Pop Warner's Carlisle football team. He ran spectacularly in a 27-6 Army win. In a Thanksgiving snowstorm, Thorpe had 3 touchdowns and 2 field goals. In a 32-0 victory over Brown, he was named an All-American again. 2 months later, Worcester, Massachusetts Telegram discovered Thorpe's pay-for-play past. During the summers of 1909 and 1910, Thorpe was paid, reports have him earning from $2 a game to $35 a week, for playing minor league baseball.
"This is a very serious charge, Mr. Thorpe. Do you have any defense to offer?"
"I don't know what to defend. I can't see that I've done anything wrong."
"You did accept money."
"Yes. For room, board, and expenses only. I wasn't playing for the money that was in it. I like baseball. It seemed like a good way to keep in training over the summer."
He naively used his real name, unlike other collegians that adopted pseudonyms to foil amateur rules.
"But I didn't know about these rules."
"Jim, ignorance is no excuse."
In January 1913, Thorpe was stripped of his amateur status, and with it, his 2 Olympic gold medals. After leaving Carlisle, Thorpe signed to play baseball and be a gate attraction for the New York Giants. In 1915, Thorpe played 2 football games for the Canton Bulldogs for a pricey $250 per contest.
It was a game that had probably hit its biggest bumps in the 19-teens. Pro football was gambling infested. They didn't tackle. Games were fixed and ringers were brought in and all kinds of charges were made against pro football.
Pro football was regarded, I think, by the press somewhere in the vicinity of pro wrestling as an exhibition, really.
Thorpe legitimized pro football. He was the first major successful hero who played under his own name. He paved the way for other great collegiate football players to start playing in the NFL and not feel like they had to hide from it.
The average crowd when Jim Thorpe was not playing in that era was 1,200. When Jim played, it was between 8 and 10,000.
From 1915, when he first signed with the Canton Bulldogs, through 1919, there was just nobody that could compare with him. There were guys that could kick as well, or run almost as fast, or with almost as much power, or play defense almost as well. But no one could do all those things so well as him.
He decided to stay on as the biggest drawing card for a team that would be recognized as world champion in 1916, 1917, and 1919.
This was an athlete that America would have learned about solely through the newspapers. There was no broadcasting. Very few people ever saw Jim Thorpe perform. Jim Thorpe's reputation and stature as the greatest athlete of the first half century came as a result of his achievements.
I think it's remarkable that he became such a figure of prominence, basically on his own ability, his own performance, and through word of mouth in this country.
He was doing athletic feats that nobody previously had done in a number of different sports. I really believe that Jim Thorpe was a physical mutation.
Max Baer wanted him to be a boxer. He actually sparred with Max a few times, and Max said that he could have been a champion.
He even went to Boston one time and won a ballroom dancing contest. Jim Thorpe, ballroom dancer.
Someone that asked if he could do something, and he'd just get up and do it. He didn't ever feel that he had to train to become a good athlete. He was a natural athlete.
The fields were slower and boggier. They had terrible shoes. Their jerseys were stuffed with flannel. And when they got wet, they weighed 15 pounds. He could run like that with all that crap on him. My God, how great he must have been. LaDainian Tomlinson has it much easier than Jim Thorpe ever had it.
Thorpe signed with the Chicago Cardinals to make one last appearance against the Chicago Bears on November 30th, 1928.
Let me take it again, I tell you.
Okay, Jim, take fullback. 32 on two.
Jim Thorpe played a few minutes, but was unable to get anywhere. One reporter wrote.
One, two, three.
In his 40s and muscle-bound, Thorpe was a mere shadow of his former self. Thorpe's days as a competitive athlete were over. Without sports, Thorpe drifted. His drinking, an issue before, became destructive. There were many fights and almost as many jobs. He took odd jobs under assumed names, working as a painter, ditch digger, deckhand, auto plant guard, and bar bouncer. The 50s brought him renewed fame. Besides being voted the greatest athlete of the first half of the century by the Associated Press, with Babe Ruth placing second, he was portrayed by Burt Lancaster in the 1951 film Jim Thorpe, All-American. Thorpe died at 64 of a heart attack on March 28, 1953. His body was moved to Mauchunk, Pennsylvania, a small town that changed its name to Jim Thorpe. It was not until October 13, 1982, that the International Olympic Committee finally agreed to restore Thorpe's gold medals. Thorpe became a charter member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, where a life-size statue of Thorpe adorns the lobby beneath the dome of the rotunda. He was voted number 7 among ESPN's 50 greatest American athletes of the 20th century. In a poll of sports fans conducted by ABC Sports, Thorpe was voted the greatest athlete of the 20th century out of 15 other athletes, including Muhammad Ali, Babe Ruth, Jesse Owens, Wayne Gretzky, Jack Nicklaus, and Michael Jordan. There wouldn't be an NFL without Jim Thorpe. He gave the league credibility as its first president and on-field star. Today, we know him most from faded photographs and newspaper articles. yet his legend runs on.
We hear the faintest echo of what he was, but it's loud enough. Had anybody been there to see the real thing, I think we'd call him hands down the greatest player who ever lived.
And there you have it. And this day in history, always, Greg Hengler does such a great job. And what a life story. And again, that Burt Lancaster performance is as good as it gets. And that movie's very modern in many different ways. And what Thorpe did, how he did it, the ease with which he did it. And as you're watching the signings of sixth men in the NBA getting $10 million a year, that Thorpe had no money, had nothing. This was a day when professional sports, well, it wasn't very professional. And the athletes didn't get much, except beaten up. They played for the love of the game, and there's something to that. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. As always, Our This Day in History, brought to us by Hillsdale College. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale comes to you. Check out their great online courses. The C.S. Lewis course is fantastic. Go to hillsdale.edu.